On today's episode of Real Growth Podcast, I'm here with a very special guest, PJ Calkins. To be honest with you, this is going to be a really fun episode because he started in business at the ripe old age of 9 years old, worked in a button factory, worked and owned a bar, and is also the CEO of a tech company. Welcome to the Real Growth Podcast. PJ!
All right, here we are.
Dude, thanks for joining us on the Real Growth Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, Nick, all this right. is sweet. I like this space you got here. This is cool.
You know, people oftentimes say that, and I actually really like it too. It's really homey, and I just feel like you're in like a living room. I don't know. I love it. I wish I knew how to play the drums, but I don't. Anyways, today on the Real Growth Podcast, everybody, we got a really special guest, PJ Calkins. You know, he's an entrepreneur extraordinaire. Another awesome story, working in not only family business, but also having a bar and a button company and CEO of a tech company. His story is just really great. And I think for a lot of listeners out there, I think, PJ, you'll be able to give us a lot of pointers and just come out some ideas of, hey, what this is all about is being an entrepreneur and growing as an individual, both as in your personal life and your business life. And I just think your story is really cool. And in fact, I'm actually really excited to learn about like more of the beginning side of things, because obviously I know bits and pieces of it, but just to kind of go through, you know, your life and you know, how you got started and kind of your mindset on things. So how I usually like starting this is just tell us a little bit about you, you know, where did you grow up and you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, I'm married. I got two kids, you know, 7 and 11. So that's, been a big part of, you know, life right now.
Yeah.
Grew up kind of a part of my childhood in Illinois, suburb of Chicago, Melrose Park area. And then moved up to northern Wisconsin and had a completely different experience up there, where I went to middle school and graduated high school there. And then shortly after graduating, then we moved to Rochester. And with that came our button factory. That was something that we started back in Chicago when I was 9 years old with my siblings and my parents.
Wow. Okay. So I'm just going to dive right into it. Okay, so 9 years old, PJ running around. Who came up with, like, how did the button factory come to be? I want to hear this.
My parents, I've always been very entrepreneurial. They were doing school assemblies. My dad is a musician. My mom and him are songwriters. So they had put school assemblies, drug prevention. You know, you got to remember this is like late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, yeah.
So the war on drugs was like really big. And so they were in the suburbs of Chicago, southern Wisconsin, even in Minnesota, Iowa, Indiana, Michigan, were doing school assemblies for elementary and, you know, basically preschool up to maybe fifth, sixth grade is kind of where they kind of cut that off for the age group. And we saw an opportunity, and it was my mom's idea to ask her dad, my grandpa, for, you know, Christmas present for the three kids that, you know, that winter, set of toys or whatever, can you get them a button machine? And there was this mechanical single use button machine that she had found out of a catalog, and, he bought us a button machine. So that was our Christmas present that year. We unwrapped it, and there was this, you know, button machine that then we all learned to use. And at the time, my sister being the youngest and drawing pictures, my mom was just like, hey, we're going to put this into, you know, the button template, and then the boys can cut it out, and then PJ and Justin can learn how to do the machine. So that probably was, you know, sat that winter with us just doing art projects. And then it was that next, you know, fall that my brother and I had the idea to, you know, my mom and dad at the time were marketing to schools, and they had this big book of, it was like the school database, but it, you know, it was in print, name, number, location of the superintendent, the principal. And we literally just started cold calling.
Wow.
I learned very quick.
Cold calling at the age of 9?
Yeah, I learned really quick at 9 that that was not my forte and I was terrible at it because I was super nervous. However, my brother at 7 was like, I don't care.
Wait, does Justin still not care?
Oh, yeah. He's still at the Bun Factory.
Oh,
he's
Justin,
still like head of sales,
can you teach me how
thing.
To cold call? Yeah. I would really love some help on that because I like
sales
PJ.
And customer service. Still
oh, my
to
gosh.
This day.
All right. We might need to get Justin out here and teach me for sure on how to cold call because I'm like you, PJ. So this is crazy because I mean, I love that. So what was once like literally like a hobby or like an art project, as you put it. You learned how to monetize that. Now that is like, that's so entrepreneurial. It's crazy. I love it. That's awesome. So you were 9, Justin was 7, you said? And how old was your sister?
6.
Okay. So who was, I'm just curious. Do you remember? I'm sure you do. Who was your first customer then?
It was the school, Krista McAuliffe School. I can't remember what suburb of Chicago. It was a school my parents had played at several years in the past. And you know, like our marketing, you know, pitch initially. Now the first day didn't go very well. We didn't get a sale that first day. It was, you know, in my mind, it was like the very next day, but which it probably was maybe a week or so, or there were several weeks where my mom decided she's going to homeschool us that year. Huh. So then we were home during the school day, able to make calls. And then two, she was actually going to like write the script. And like, she started to train up Justin on how to like, here's the pitch. Here's how you're going to get through the secretary to get to talk to either the principal or the superintendent. Those are the two decision makers that write the checks. And once we got that, then it started snowballing really quick. But the target was, hey, people familiar with our parents because they've done school assemblies there for the last few years. Sure. So Krista McAuliffe will never forget that one. Can't remember the woman's name, but she was like a customer of ours for like 20 some years.
Wow.
And so it was kind of fun. She'd call every year to reorder. Even though, you know, as the technology and online ordering process grew, she still would call in. You know, there was a while where I was answering, you know, doing customer service and taking orders. She talked to me, hey, how's it going? You know, we had this, you know, 15, 20 year relationship. Then when I moved on, then Justin still picked up that. And, you know, I do think she either moved schools or retired at some point, but she definitely moved on. But I do remember our first like big order because hers was a little bit small. And at this time, a big order was anything over like 400, 500. Well, that was the Gurnee, Illinois school district, and they bought it for their Red Ribbon Week, which, you know, drug prevention week in those schools. All the kids get a little ribbon, put on their shirt. We pitched it as, hey, that ribbon will tear and fall off. Why don't you get a button that represents that, and it'll stay on, and it'll last a lot longer. So those are our first two customers that, I'll never forget those, you know, for us. I was the one that made the buttons at that point. That's where I filled in mine. I was like, all right, get the orders. I'll sit in the room all night long.
Punch it or whatever.
Yeah.
How long did that take? So you did it all on that one first machine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We were all on that one little machine for, you know, I got to imagine, you know, thinking about when we moved up to northern Wisconsin, that's when we invested in like the big machines equipment, we still use today. But yeah, it was probably the first 3, 4, 5 years.
Wow.
But again, we were only doing a few thousand buttons a year, you know, and as little side kid money. And it was more about the excitement of being entrepreneurial and, you know, the parent, you know, we build a chart, you know, here's the break even point. And then when that happens, hey, we can go out and spend money and have a dinner and go to the candy shop. And
that's amazing, PJ. I love that because oftentimes, you know, I think the best way to learn business is by actually doing it.
100%.
And you guys had that like at such a young age. That's honestly invaluable.
What
you learned those first few years, you're never going to forget. And that's better than, in my opinion, sorry, higher education out there, but that, in my opinion, that's better than any education. Sure. This is real world stuff that, you know, your parents taught you, which I think is really cool.
And we lived in a neighborhood, you know, when we lived in, you know, the suburb of Chicago, Melrose Park, we had a bunch of neighborhood kids. We had a Kool-Aid stand during the summer that we did. That one we like crushed like two summers in a row. We really did very well. Just because, you know, we had a great location.
Yeah.
We figured out how to, you know, put signs and kids holding signs 2 blocks ahead to say, hey, upcoming Kool-Aid, 25 cents, parking available. And then we started getting like UPS, FedEx drivers, DHL drivers that would stop like regularly, tip us $20, $50. And so, and then at the end of the year, we'd throw a big like pizza party for all the neighborhood kids. And we'd go to, you know, at the time it was a Leaps and Bounds, but it'd be like equivalent of Air and Sanity today.
Awesome.
So yeah, we always had that going while we lived there. And then we moved up to Northern Wisconsin. And then that's kind of when like the internet was starting to take off. And my mom taught herself how to write HTML code, which is like the first script to get a website out back then, figured out how to get a website published. And, you know, to date, we still claim, and I, you know, haven't found anything on any Wayback Machine or Wikipedia that I think we were the first like button manufacturing company in America to have a website. And then that's when we really like started to take off, because then we were getting orders from all over the place. And
okay, so let's talk about that. So yeah, at that stage, so you're in Northern Wisconsin. So how old are you now?
I moved up there. I was probably sixth grade. So yeah, 12, 13 years old.
Middle school.
Yep, yep.
And stuff really starts.
Yeah.
Coming in home.
My mom published the website. And, you know, again, in my memory, it was like, well, the next day. But I'm sure there were several weeks, maybe even a few months. But we got a call from an import-export company out of Florida, Devshire Imports. You know, another one you'll never forget, because this is the order that took us from the little tiny machine
to the next level,
the big one. He called. He had an idea for this button called Too Blessed to Be Stressed. And he wanted a smiley face or a cross. And, you know, we sent him samples, and his connection was he had basically all the Walgreens in America. There was a fishbowl of products sold right at the register, point of sale. And he's like, I own that space. And whatever products I put in there, they'll buy, they'll test market. And if it sells, they will continue to buy from us. And that's one of my retail spots I have across the entire country. So he test marketed it a few spots in the South. It went nuts. Like, people were buying it, you know, for him. Buttons are very, it's a penny business. So at large volume, you can get a button for 15, 25, 30 cents, especially back then. Now pricing and costs have gone up since, but, and then you could flip that for $1, $2, $3 as a point of sale. So, you know, for an import export company, those are huge margins for very little effort of, and basically of just taking, you know, bring it, ship it all to the warehouse. We'll pick and pack it and ship it out and sell it to the people that we have connections with already. So that really took it. And the first order was only for 2,500 buttons.
Okay.
And that was like, you know, my mom hung up the phone and holy crap, we got to figure out how we're going to make 2,500 buttons, because it'll take us weeks, if not months, to do it on this little machine.
PJ, you're not going to school. You're going to be punching buttons.
Yeah. So she did it, you know, researched it, you know, called, you know, our part supplier. You know, we had built relationships with another button company in Illinois. Wally was his name. He actually stamped parts for a very long time. I'm not sure if he's still in the business, but, he had a son about the same age as I, and we were always like aware of each other's button making skills and prowess. And when I heard that he could do buttons solo on the big machine, then I was like, well, then I should be able to do that too. But, so she found the manufacturer, and it was just like so happened they were based out of the Midwest, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Oh, crazy cool.
They manufactured machines and then sold the parts for the machines. And essentially we did the quote based on what do we need to get the machine, the first round of parts, some extra parts, and basically start the business. And Devshire said yes, and all of a sudden she called the company, and a couple weeks later we had this big new machine wheeling into our, you know, tiny house in the kitchen, you know, basically. And it was funny, the guy that delivered the machine, him and my mom joked that the machine was worth more than the house we were living in at that time, because we were in this kind of tiny little shack at the time. And that really kickstarted us to then being a real button manufacturing company. And then every year, you know, more and more orders came in through the website and online. And more and more machines. Then we started hiring staff, and it's still running in St. Charles today and still clipping away.
That is so amazing. And I think for you guys to like have the foresight, honestly, I mean, back then with the internet, it was it was a frontier, right? Like nobody knew how to navigate that really all that well. And I remember the dial-up internet days still, and the AIM, and you've got mail.
Oh, yeah.
That's the time. You guys were, truly ahead of your game when it came to e-commerce, right? Which is really, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's fascinating to hear that. And you guys saw how powerful the internet could be even back then before it was even really a thing.
Yeah. And you know, like one of the things that, you know, we held on to with one of our brands in that space was like the ability to call in your credit card over the phone. Because at the early ages of the internet, it was really worrisome to be like, wait, I'm typing this in and like, is this secure? And, you know, compared to how things are secure now, it was not very secure then. People were still doing it and expecting customers to do that. Well, ours was, no, you can just fill out the form, call us up, talk to a real person, you know, give your credit card over the phone so you know it's safe and secure. And that ran, I mean, we still do a lot of it with some legacy customers, but that was like the bloodline of that one brand up until like, you know, 2010, 2015. Huh. Like it still was like the main ordering.
Yeah.
But again, the demographic, the people that brand attracted was those, you know, somewhat older generations, not feeling safe online, but they loved the ability like, oh, this is great that I can do that. The other companies won't even accept an order over the phone, you know? So that was how we evolved with the internet. And that was one of our first kind of getting in there with being a manufacturing company and being the first online way back in the early 90s.
Early 90s. Gosh, that's amazing. Wow. That's really incredible. So then at that time, PJ, was it still just the family then, like working in the business?
Yep.
So then at what stage was it like, oh my gosh, this has gotten to be such a big business for us, like we can't handle it? Because I remember, PJ, I must have just gotten started in the business. You guys were in on 19th Street.
Right next to Paws and Claws.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but it was before that. I remember going in, it was past Cinemagic. Weren't you in that? There's a building further west.
We that was like
because I remember going in there and seeing all the people making buttons. I'm like, whoa, I didn't even know this. Like, this is cool.
Yep. We were in that spot for a while, the two-story
spot. Yeah, you got it, the two-story. Yeah, because that's when I remember seeing, I think I saw Justin. I want to say Justin was there when I went in there randomly. Because I was trying to lease that space out for the owner. So, what stage then did you guys make the decision? Okay, now this is becoming bigger than just our nuclear family.
Yeah.
Here. Like, we got to do something more and really pump out some more product.
So, the Too Blessed to Be Stressed, that ran for several years. And that was like the main bread and butter. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but I'm pretty sure we got to like several hundred thousands of those were sold across the country, primarily in the South. That is one area. Like, they did test market it like in Wisconsin and Minnesota, where we would like see it at our local Walgreens, and it just didn't hit like it did down there. But so that ran for several years, and then 9/11 hit. Okay. And then that was, as I'm looking back, really when Devshire Importers pivoted and they're like, we need flag buttons. Anything that's got a flag on, everyone's buying up. Yeah. And then that was where it was like everywhere it sold and worked. And then we did like smaller sizes, so we had more variety. Hey, you can get a big old flag button. You can get a little tiny one, you know? And so that one expanded our product line. And then that is when we really needed to go and get basically people outside the family to start. So that was when I remember us first like having employees or, you know, team members outside the family. But it really turned when we moved to Rochester.
Okay.
And so my stepdad, longtime IBMer, he was there during the heydays and was part of that big migration to Rochester. Oh, yeah. You know, all the talent, it was like Silicon Valley from what I hear. He was part of that. And we moved to Rochester when him and my mom got married, and we brought the button factory with. And with his programming skills, his MBA, and all of his knowledge from IBM, he really kind of took us to that next level. Now, when we moved to Rochester, we were still in his garage, and which was really funny because I remember when we got to like 60, 70 boxes going out a day, the UPS driver came down and said, you know, your neighbors are wondering what the heck's going on in here. Like, they're just seeing all these little tiny boxes coming out nonstop.
Oh my gosh.
And I always have to reassure him like, hey, it's a legit business. They sell buttons online, you know?
Yeah.
So that's really when it started to turn. That's when, you know, anyone we knew, friends of friends, like, you need a job, you've got a job. We've got more buttons than we can produce right now. We have large orders that, you know, can fill the time. We've got small, quick orders that need to go out immediately and kind of quick. And that was really when we turned and then got too big to be in the garage. And then we moved over to one of the spots on 19th. And then we were at the, you know, further down past, you know, where you were talking about the warehouse space. And then we got into the building across the street from Paws and Claws. And that was a big 5,000 square foot space. And then we moved out to St. Charles maybe like 4 or 5 years ago.
So then, PJ, at what stage did you start yourself pivoting from working in the family business to, you know, where you're at today at CW?
Yep.
When did that start?
Turned 30.
When you turned 30.
Yep. I realized my resume looked pretty bleak if my stepdad and mom got, you know, hit by a car or in a plane crash or anything like that. And it was like, you know, I probably should get something going on the side just to like, one, you know, kind of validate to myself that I do kind of know what I'm doing. You know, it's easy to get caught up in just like, hey, I'm just running the family business. Mm-hmm. I know what I know. I do it really well, but does this translate to anything else? Or mm-hmm. if, you know, buttons all of a sudden disappear or not the thing or the business, it, you know, goes under, do I have anything that then pivots to something else? So while I was still with the family business, I kind of thought, turned 30 and was like, well, you know, maybe I should just see what's out there and see if I can get something on the side. And so I put my feelers out there, and that's when I got on the board with the CWS thing. And 9 years later, I'm running that company now.
Wow. So yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit. So what, I guess, what made you think I'm going to apply at CWS? Like, was there, hey, I'm interested? Because at that time, there's a lot of website stuff,
sure.
right? So were you like, oh, I love the internet and computers,
yeah.
and I'm good with that? Or like, how did you?
This is actually a really funny story, because being at the Button Factory, we then, you know, when we moved to our bigger space across the street from Paws and Claws on 19th,
mm-hmm.
We decided to kind of open up a storefront and be like more of like a full service print shop. So all the technology we had invested in and learned to make like the most beautiful button, made great business cards and postcards and all this stuff. So we started doing some local business, and that was the Image Splash print
Image
shop
Splash, yeah.
brand.
Yep.
So with that, we started getting into some local businesses, and they saw and knew that we had a website. It was performing pretty well. And there was like this, you know, and I know the history of CWS now, but there was a time where they were kind of less than high quality on the service level, and they lost some customers. And a few of those customers came into my office and were like, hey, Peach, I need you to get my website up. I need you to host this. And I was like, well, I got to, you know, we have our own servers, you know, that host our website. There's definitely room for others. And so I kind of was doing some, you know, website work for our button and print shop customers just in that moment. And so my initial like learning about CWS was like, wow, this company sounds like they suck. Like, they're just like, really?
So
like,
says the CEO.
Like these guys are coming in here saying their website's completely down. They have no access to email, and they're like panicking. I'm like, how can a company do that? Well, I learned after being on the team what was going on there, and a lot of turnover, a lot of change going on within the company. And of course, that's going to happen when any company goes through those growing pains and that stuff. So, but when I inquired about, you know, a position, told my family that, hey, I'm going to look for some other stuff, see what's out there. It was actually my mom that was like, make sure you apply and talk to Alan at CWS. She had gone on a Chamber of Commerce trip to New York. There was some award that I can't remember if what businesses or who, but they were on the board together, and they kind of knew each other, and they had a good time in New York. And I remember my mom coming back and being like, hey, that Alan guy, I think you'd really like him. Like, you know, you guys speak the same kind of language, and you know, you guys are visionaries and want to like grow and do all this stuff. And so when I, you know, put feelers out there locally, she was like, don't make any decisions until you apply. And I wasn't even thinking about CWS at all because of my previous experience with their customers that kind of had some issues there, but trusted, you know, my mom and said, all right, yeah, I'll apply. And at the time, it just, you know, timing is one, you know, another thing. They actually had two positions open. And there was one for a programming position, which at the time I was doing a lot of coding for our websites and building applications and processes within our you know, manufacturing operations. And they had a sales position, and I applied for both.
Okay.
And I went in, and the first few interviews for the sales position, they're like, well, we're not sure if this is a real good fit. But because you applied for the programming position, you know, that's Alan's realm. We're going to have him have a chat. After I talked to Alan, next thing you know, he's like, I don't think you should be in the back with the programmers. I think you should be like leading, not leading, but on our sales team and being kind of our tech salesperson, and he hired me. So,
wow.
One thing led to another. And,
wow. So yeah. You started. So what initially, PG, what initially were you doing then? Like, what did your typical day-to-day look like in those beginning years at CWS?
Probably a lot of what the RGI sales guys looks like now. You know, I was building relationships locally. We sold websites and marketing and hosting and going to chamber events. Yeah. You know, I came in at a time there was, you know, kind of a backlog of customers that they had that either hadn't been touched in a while or, you know, had some like older applications that were needing to be updated. And so, you know, I kind of got handed a few of the bigger local groups that had like more complex problems. So yeah, I just kind of got thrown into it. It was just like, hey, we need business in the door. And it was very heavily commission based at that time too. Sure. So yeah, I was pounding on doors and doing the old legacy traditional sales process.
And it worked.
Yeah. I mean, I will not say that the sales processes that I was executing is why it worked.
Yep.
I think it was more just like the timing of things for me. You know, I've got a coworker, John McMahon. I'm sure you've met him. He used to live here in Rochester, moved to Wisconsin a few mm-hmm. years ago, but he got hired like a few weeks after me. And honestly, I've told him this several times where it's like, if you would have come on first, you would have hit those first big sales because those were just timing. The list was handed to me. Your list was this other group.
Yeah.
And so that's where the first two like big projects that I was, you know, able to lock in, it literally was timing. And I just spoke the language that they were able to from the sales side, the tech side. John, he knows that tech side too. So that's where I fully believe like, hey man, if you would have started here 2 weeks, those two big deals that, you know, everyone got real excited about, they would have been his.
So then TJ, so throughout the years then, like how did your career progress within CWS?
Yeah.
And what did that look like in that path to, you know, going from a, you know, I mean, you're still an employee, but,
yep.
you know, starting off employee to now you're the man. I yep. mean, so what did that look like throughout that process? And you know, what did it take, I guess, for you as an individual sure. to grow yep. in that, right?
Yeah, so
to grow in that space.
It started back to why I pivoted from the family business yep. in the first place was, hey, I want to just, you know, one, prove it to myself that these skills do translate.
Yeah, sure.
And then two, I'm here to grow and learn more always and continuing to do that. So that never stopped. So I was always looking at ways, whether it's just, hey, I'm just going to improve my role, what this is now working in a family business and then coming to, which was, you know, somewhat of a family business. Now, Alan didn't employ a bunch of siblings and cousins and things, but it was run by him and his wife mm-hmm. and they ran the show. And there was a lot of those family business, you know, nuances and things that, I was accustomed to.
Yeah.
And so for me, I treated it like it was my own business, which again, I came on to CWS. That was one of their core values as well. Like yeah. act like an owner, you know, yep. do more with less,
yes.
you know, these types of things that, you know, coming from the family business, we just naturally did for survival
yep.
that, okay. Yeah. I do that just naturally. So coming on, I, you know, always asked a lot of questions and, was always looking for new avenues and ways to help the company grow, even though it might've been outside my role at that time. And, you know, eventually I came across a new way to sell websites, a new way to package them. And, you know, I got the free rein to test it out. You know, I even like, hey, Alan, here's this, you know, webinar. He's like, you watch it. If you think it's great, give me some bullets on it and tell me what you want to do about it. So I watched it, did it, and said, hey, I want to start pitching it. Go for it. Give it a shot. So I started pitching it. Then it started hitting and working. We ultimately switched our whole process and team to that, and we didn't sell websites any other way after that. And then we started, like, growing, and that was, like, really fun to see and
yeah. So
being a part of that.
Let's touch on that real quick. So yeah. when you started, how many employees were there?
At CWS?
Yeah.
Oh, man, there might have been, like, 25.
Okay.
Maybe 28.
And just so everybody out there knows, how many are you at today?
We're at 14.
Okay. Okay. So I'm interested to hear what happened in regards to that. So the product line changed, right?
100%.
Okay. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. So
when did that shift occur? See, because yeah. the way I look at it is, dude, you pivot and you, every time you've pivoted, knock on wood, it's worked out it's worked out well.
So far, so good.
Okay. So what happened, PJ? Like, what event occurred, or what was going on where you're like, hey, we gotta make this pivot here?
Yeah. One, the local market was getting harder to, one, find talent and retain talent, along with the value for what we were doing. Competition was creeping in from all avenues. Okay. You know, just thinking about websites in general, they were becoming commoditized where, hey, anyone can go get a Squarespace. WordPress is becoming more robust. Any high school kid or college kid that, you know, has any basic level of design prowess can get a server and can start a company and offer really low, really high quality offerings. I know several people who do it. They do great work. It's hard to compete with that. So you're really pitching on value. So we had that trajectory. We kind of saw the writing on the wall. Even though, like I said, our new growth-driven design, you know, packaged websites, you know, I was managing 7-8 clients at a time. We had other people on the team were managing 4 or 5. So, you know, we had a really good recurring revenue base on that. Mm-hmm. But we knew eventually we were working ourselves out of a job. You do enough, you train enough of the customer on the website,
and they're going to do it.
They should be able to do it. That was always our goal. That was actually how we pitched it as. But you get to your second, third, fourth year of renewal, then all of a sudden they're like, you know, I'm just going to hire, you know, this kid out of college, or I'm going to hire an internal staff. We kind of get the gist of how this is operating, mm-hmm. and you've got us all set up with the great tools and trained us how to do it. And that was great. That was part of the success that we pitched and modeled our whole operation on. But you work yourself out of a job eventually.
Yeah.
So you have competition coming from all angles, software, other industries, smaller people, smaller operations. And then you're also having where, hey, if we do a really good job, the customer doesn't stay with us longer than 3-4 years. And we were already starting to see that. So we had an opportunity kind of fall in our lap, a project from Mayo Clinic that we helped develop the web version of a 9-question survey that measures burnout and distress in healthcare professionals. And after the first iteration of that, our owner, Alan, really saw a great opportunity, knowing that, hey, the docs, the researchers, the brains behind this, they're not marketers, salespeople, they're not mm-hmm. going to go and sell this, but there's opportunity for other organizations and other, you know, in healthcare systems to use this tool. Let's see if we can license it and sell it and do that for them. So we got a license with Mayo Clinic to offer that tool. We've now built it out fully online, and I have completely shifted the entire company to that one product.
And what is that product called?
The Wellbeing Index.
Wellbeing Index.
Yep.
And there's an app and...
Yep.
And you guys build all that out and...
Absolutely. You know, we still have our legacy customers. We still host and do some websites. You know, but we're not out looking for a new business necessarily in that space. It is now the tool and everything around supporting that tool and bringing that to as many organizations as possible.
Yeah. So how have you seen that success? It's something that you guys have the rights to, and then you can go out and license it to other organizations.
Correct.
So are you able to tell us some of those other organizations that utilize that?
They utilize their tool?
Yeah.
I can tell you some of the past ones that I know.
Okay, sure.
You know, like, I'm not sure where we're at contractually with all kind of our newer ones.
For sure. Because,
they all have the ability to opt out on whether we can say they work with us or not.
Got it.
But we've worked with, you know, large health systems outside of Mayo Clinic, like Common Spirit Health. And, you know, they used to be Dignity Health. They've now changed over to Common Spirit. John Hopkins, Henry Ford. Those are some UPenn.
Yeah.
University of North Carolina. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's probably 100, 130 organizations currently licensing the tool right now, but we've had users and burnout and distress detected at over 800 organizations worldwide, where we at least have a few users at that organization using the.
And I'm sure this was super helpful, especially during, of course, the pandemic.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm sure you guys saw.
Yep.
Did you see an increase of,
there
of
was,
usage during that time?
There, like, you know, during the, you know, the onslaught of the pandemic, of course, we couldn't get in contact with anyone because everyone was on the front lines.
Yes.
Which was, you know, totally to be expected. But yes, there was that, like, you know, as we pended our pent-up demand that came back once, hey, they're opening things back up again. We've got this under control. And hey, we know how crazy it was, and we want to make sure everyone is, you know, we get an assessment done to see where everyone's at. And part of, you know, the great thing about our tool is that, you know, it's not just a one and done thing. It's really like, hey, get an assessment, get some baseline data, figure out some maybe hotspot areas where you either are doing really well, where you can gauge and figure out what's going on there to maybe apply it somewhere else, but also find out where you might not be doing very well, whether that's a location, a department, and then really focus on implementing some change to fix that or solve that or make that better, and then doing another assessment to see if that change actually had any lift or improvement. So we had a big onslaught, you know, that late 2020, early 2021 of organizations come on, and that's where, you know, the whole company kind of got reshuffled and reorganized. That's why we're at 14 people now. We sold our office too over on Second Street and have gone full remote, and basically all of our new hires the last 3-4 years have all been from all over the country,
and that's been working out really well.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess your net can go anywhere now, so you probably are getting some really high quality people.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking a little bit before we started this about that. I wouldn't say the quality necessarily changes. It's just more like instead of getting 20 applicants that we
get a lot more, sure.
I get like 300.
Quantity,
you know?
Yeah, the amount. Yeah.
There's a lot that you got to sift through where, because it's, oh, remote job. Yeah, I'd love that, you know, but yeah, you just get more to a bigger pool to kind of pick from. And
so I want to touch on that just a little bit too. And I know we're getting close to time here, but PJ, culturally, right? We always talk about how important work culture is.
100%.
How is that work? Because I view you guys and you seem like you have a great work culture, and it's like, yeah, and we're fully remote. So how do you, as the CEO, how do you create that culture that, you know, makes people, you retain your people, you keep them happy? Like, what do you guys do to build a team, I guess?
Sure. I guess the first thing is we spend intentional effort working on the culture and trying our best to maintain the culture. Now, we've got a team of 14. Maybe 5 of them never were in the old office and experienced that culture that we had. You know, as we were talking before, you know, questioning, hey, do you guys still got the ping pong table and all your crazy rules? And yeah, we do, but it's just when we're all together and we come across a ping pong table and we're like, all right, how did we do that? All right. And that comes back. But now that we're fully distributed, we have a committee that focuses on that culture.
Cool.
I lean on, you know, 2 team members pretty heavily to really take ownership and lead on making sure that we do our best, even though we're in the digital world and we're on Zoom, to maintain some level of company culture that we had in the office. And the other thing is, we really prioritize like the moments we do have in person.
Sure.
So, we fly everyone in once a year. And this year it'll be in September for our conference that we're hosting at the Civic Center and
Arts
Center. But yeah, in the past it's been in July. Everyone comes in for 3-4 nights. We do a big team meeting, alignment. We'll have a fun night, and it's really just to have everyone do that in person. We've now started this last year getting the whole team together once, and then each of our like departments, they'll have like a in-person thing. So pretty much everyone is seeing someone in person at least 2 times a year, regardless of where they are in the country. And then for all of our like Southeast Minnesota people, we kind of prioritize, I was telling Chris that, hey, we got 4 of us that all are in Minnesota,
right,
or in Rochester even. Let's do this meeting Thursday in person if we can, you know, and really starting to at least prioritize those in-person efforts. But really boils down to just, we do spend an intentional effort on company culture and maintaining it as best as we can in the remote world that we're in.
God, that's awesome. That's really cool. So I want to just shift real quickly away from kind of the business side of things and go into more of a personal side of things. And I always like asking people about this, because being an entrepreneur, PJ, owning your own business, still owning your own business, also being the CEO of a company, you have a family.
Sure do.
And you can't forget about your family. And so, you know, someone that is a high achiever like you, who you're super motivated, you're running 2 successful companies. Like, what does that look like? How do you, it's hard sometimes, right?
Sure. Yep.
And so how do you do it? Because there's a lot of people out there that this is always the magic question, right? Like, how do you find time to do everything that you do?
Sure. Well, to answer that specific question, when people bring that, I say, well, time is relative, right?
True.
But at a high level, and this is something that, you know, working at CWS and being part of the well-being index, where it is about, you know, wellness. And we had a saying, and we still say it today when we were, you know, we really need to grind down. It's still like, hey, we don't want to burn ourselves out fighting burnout. You know, like we don't want to be on that end of it. Yeah. You know, that seems counterintuitive. Yeah. And we need to practice what we preach and do that. So through that, and, you know, Dr. Schoenfeld, one of the co-developers of the Wellbeing Index, had said at a talk that I saw that, you know, work-life balance, it's not, that's actually kind of the wrong term.
Yeah.
You know, and he was speaking to a room of docs, you know. Sure. But me, you know, high-achieving, entrepreneurial type, it can apply to that where, you know, the work-life integration is a blend. And so that's where he, you know, uses that terminology.
Yeah.
It's work-life integration.
Yes.
It's not balance, because there is no way.
There isn't.
You can't,
I agree.
You can't give 30 hours and 30 hours. Yep. It's not necessarily how it works. It needs to be integrated. And when you're focusing on family, you're focusing on family and being intentional about
that
time.
Sure.
And you know, another thing also I've learned is also like communicating that intention that like, hey, I've shut everything off. We're going on this trip to spring break. I've taken the PTO. I've let the whole team know. We're fully dedicated for, you know, Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday, I got a 1 hour thing I got to hop on, but that's it. But being intentional and communicating that to the family has also been one of the main things. And then I think like if I'm doing one, two, and now three, your partner should be a part of those decisions. You know, I recently was considering maybe running for city council.
Oh yeah.
Again,
gosh, we could have a whole nother
just on that
podcast
one.
Podcast
yeah.
on that one. Jeez, I forgot about that.
But I had, you know, some other, you know, advisory opportunities, you know, side hustles that I was kind of pursuing, and brought it all to the table to my wife and kind of was thinking like, well, I think I maybe can do all of this.
Yeah.
And she's like, hell no.
Yeah.
I'm only on board with this if you just pick one.
Yeah.
And whatever it is, I can get behind, but you got to pick one. So I decided not to run for city council and not to pursue some other little side projects because I got this one advisory position that I really liked. So I went with one. But I think having that conversation as new things pop up, you know, my brothers and I, we bought a duck cleaning business 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
That was another one where it was like, hey, because of course, in something like that, there's, you know, for my role, there's usually like a lot of effort that needs to go in it right away.
Up front, yeah.
You know, get everything structurally set, get all the tools, the software, the website, the marketing, all operational, get as much of it automated as possible. And then it can be a step back where, hey, I'm just tweaking, I'm just managing, hitting the button to process payroll, making sure everyone's good to go. So that communicating that with your partner and your family. Now, you know, my kids aren't old enough to really like have opinions or thoughts of it. But my oldest, you know, she is kind of like, when I say, hey, I'm going to be doing this thing that's new, it's now, well, okay, what does that mean for me? Well, it means we might be able to do something extra special this summer, or, you know, there's that now. But including your family on those decisions and that thought process, I think that's the main initial first step. And then how you balance, I mean, again, it's there's probably a theme I'm getting here now is being intentional. Like my calendar, like it's blocked off. Like, not that it's blocked off that people can't book things, but my time for what I'm available for or what I'm doing for task work is essentially Monday through Friday completely filled in.
Yeah.
And everything, you know, whether, hey, I got to run payroll, you know, Thursday morning at 7 a.m. for this on the calendar for that. So when I look at my, you know, 7 calendars all at once, I can see across all things what's new, needing to be done, what needs to be done immediately, and focusing on those.
Thank you for that, because I always like to have that personal component, because I do feel it's so important, whether you're, you know, an owner of a business, a CEO of a business, an employee, having those types of things are really important. And hearing that from especially like a leader, I think is really cool. And PJ, I really appreciate those thoughts, because we can all learn from each other and how to make our lives better too, not only in the business world, but also in our personal lives as well. So,
sure.
So since we are the Real Growth Podcast, I need to ask you, we're going to flip back to the business side of things here. PJ, where do you see CWS going? You know, where do you see yourself, let's say 5 years from now? Where do you think you're going to take this company? Because this is super exciting.
Yeah. You know, I think for us, and we just had our alignment meeting on Monday, it's really about the diversification of the product line now that we've, you know, got a vertical, got a niche that we're in, got something that's unique. It's now kind of expanding on that. You know, what other services can right now healthcare organizations utilize or need that could maybe be adjacent to, hey, after you run the survey, what do you do next? Well, hey, maybe you need some coaching for your physician leaders, or maybe you need a, you know, chief wellness officer to come in and structure how things get executed and how priority is set and how you utilize the data that's coming out. So that for us, and you know, I think the next 5 years that, you know, will evolve again, probably from, you know, where we are now is, you know, the well-being index. As I said, hey, we're all kind of behind this new company and product to, you know, a bigger brand that is offering a wide suite of products, and the well-being index is just, you know, a piece of that tool set, that toolbox. And in addition to that, we would love to start exploring expanding outside of healthcare. We have a couple tools, a leadership impact survey that actually was validated and done just on the general workforce, that can be used in any industry, any business, to measure a leader's impact on their staff's well-being and distress. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I think in 5 years, then they, you know, instead of having just like two pieces of software, we may have several pieces of software and then a suite of, you know, products, services, and other things that are living under a bigger brand.
Okay, cool. And yep. What about the button factory? I mean, we can't forget about the button company. What,
can't. No,
that just kind of keeps chugging along.
Hey, it's an election
along.
Year, so.
Oh, big, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The button factory keeps chugging along. Great. Yep. You know, my mom, my brother, my sister, still fully running the show over there and operating that. And yeah, I mean, I imagine that this year would be another great year. When there's a polarizing candidates, there's lots of buttons sold.
All right. You know, make sure you buy your buttons. Yeah.
When there's not polarization in the presidential election, we always seen like a down year for it. So we're
so you're looking forward to
a rematch. Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. The rematch.
Fight night. Yeah. Gosh, pay-per-view. Yep. Oh my gosh. Well, that's awesome. Well, Peej, thank you honestly so much for being here today.
I
know we're coming up on time here. Are there any kind of final thoughts just about anything in general, PJ?
No, final thoughts or tidbits, but just wanted to plug our event. So here in Rochester, we are hosting the Champions of Wellness Healthcare Summit.
Nice.
It's September 17th and 18th. And we have, I can't announce it yet, but we do have a local Mayo Clinic keynote that we're in the process of locking up that we'll be announcing here shortly. But it's going to be like 2 days of talks and education on wellness and well-being for healthcare leaders to help support their staff. And usually at these events, we do get some, you know, outside of healthcare organizational leaders come checking it out to see what's going on there too. So we're excited about that. It's going to be at the Civic Center and the Arts Center.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much, PJ. You know, oftentimes I ask, if people have questions or anything, are they able to contact you?
Absolutely.
If so, okay, how can they contact you, PJ?
Yeah, you can just shoot me an email. It's pj@sbdci.com.
Perfect. Well, thanks again, Peej. I really appreciate the time. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is great.
And thank you, everybody out there, for listening or watching, whatever you're doing. keep it real, everybody, and keep growing.